was the result of an agreement primarily between the Texas Association of Defense Counsel and the Texas Trial Lawyers Association, who did the final, did the negotiating in this thing. The main phrase that was used in the all of these negotiation stages was the mini trial, to eliminate the mini trial.
On the merit.
The mini, yes, any mini trial.
You can see that under old Rule 258, when a factual issue was set up, as it were, by sworn pleadings or affidavits to the contrary, then the judge had to conduct a hearing.
There is no question about that, Your Honor. The rule says that, and the cases say that.
What then, in Rule 258, changes that? If that language is unchanged and there's merely a sentence which mandates reasonable discovery.
Your Honor, Rule 258 changes it. And again, this court does not have to speculate, because this court stated why it made that amendment. Now, here's the changes that have to be made. If you look at old 258 at the top of page 11 in the outline, it said, where such application, where such application for a change of venue is duly made. Then look at the very first line of new 258. Where such motion to transfer venue is duly made, it shall be granted. Okay. And then an entire sentence was added. An entire sentence. Reasonable discovery in support of or in opposition to the application shall be permitted, and such discovery as is relevant, including deposition testimony on file, may be attached to or incorporated by reference in the affidavit of a party, a witness, or an attorney who has knowledge of such discovery. Amended by order June 15, 83, effective September 1, 1983. Changed by amendment effective September 1, 1983 to conform to Senate Bill 898. That is the change. This court can, in amending that rule 258, specifically stated in its historical note that it was amended to conform to Senate Bill 898. Senate Bill 898 is now 15.063 and 15.064 of the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code. So if this footnote said change by amendment to conform to 15.063 and 15.064, then there would be no question.
What's the effect of the new language in 258? It says the issue thus far shall be tried by the judge. What do you think is kept behind that?
That is not new language, Your Honor. That is old language.
Okay.
The issue thus form shall be tried by the judge is in old 258 and in new 258. When the statute can amend a rule of procedure, no matter what the significance of that language was prior to 258, whether you consider the city of Irving versus Luttrell case, the city of Abilene versus Downs, any of those cases, it says tried by the jury. Whatever that history was at that time is now changed by SB 898-15.063. It's gone. It's history. And the new language and the new meaning takes place.
So, Judge Campbell, you recognize a distinction between... You recognize a distinction between Rule 87-89 venue, where the trial judge does not have to make any factual determinations. It kind of goes back to the old days of pleading, before you and I were born, where you just line up the pleading and the response and the serve pleading and the serve response, and eventually somebody loses. And there is never any factual determination made about the merits of the case or anything else under venue claiming that the county is not a convenient place. Isn't that right?
That's correct.
This is an entirely different kind of venue. The trial judge has to make a determination about fairness, really about the knowledge and the predisposition of those people who are likely to be called as jurors.
Now,
is that
you,
not
Honor.
Correct?
Your Honor, yes, that's correct.
And so it's really a fundamentally different job the trial judge has in a Rule 257 to 259 venue motion.
In a Rule 257-258 motion to transfer venue, yes, and the legislature speaks to it. Here's what it says. The court, upon motion filed and served concurrently with or before the filing of the answer, shall transfer an action to another county of proper venue. You see, Your Honor, the filing of a motion to transfer because of the inability to receive a fair trial presupposes proper venue. It presupposes proper venue. But if you can't get a fair trial, then you transfer it to another county of proper venue. Now,
do you know of any other place, though, in the in our procedures where a trial judge can make that kind of determination on the basis of affidavits and pleadings alone?
In all, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Where a trial judge can weigh the credibility of witnesses on the basis of pleadings and affidavits?
In all of the proper and improper venue matters are the same procedure.
But there's no way. You just see if it's been pled. The trial judge never looks to the truth. You can make the falsest allegation in the world and get your venue changed or sustained. And then the same issues come up in the trial, that is the merits of the case, and the venue can be reviewed on appeal. But here you've got two problems. We don't just weigh the affidavit and see who has the most or who filed the last and determine whether the trial's fair or not. And secondly, Judge Gonzalez's question, if the trial judge determines it can be fair here and goes ahead with the trial, how do you ever show unfairness on the basis of the case that you're proving or opposing during the course of the trial?
Your Honor, your basic premise is incorrect in that there is nothing in the rules on proper and improper venue that has this type of situation. And this was one of the big disputes when this bill was finally passed, as SB 898 as introduced said, it shall be determined strictly by pleadings. Of course the Texas Association of Defense Counsel disagreed with that. So they came back, the agreement was it shall be pleadings and affidavits. Trial lawyers agreed to that. The defense counsel then said, no, it's too much element for fraud and chance for wrongdoing in that type of situation. We want this language. And they added the language that the court shall impose sanctions, including attorney's fees for wrongdoings in presenting a venue issue. The Texas Association of Trial Lawyers wouldn't accept that. So then, with Judge Pope, they came down with the language that provides for the harmless error. And that is the only section in these rules that apply strictly to the appellate courts. There is nothing in that language, section 2, 4D2, that applies to the trial courts. It shall in no case be harmless error. All right, that is the only limiting language in Section 4. Now, to Judge Gonzalez's question, how do you preserve an error? Let me tell you what Price in his law review article, the historian on this thing, provided. And that's at page 878 and 879 of his law review article, which is in our original brief. He says that The fact that the issue is not whether venue was or was not properly determined, but is whether venue was or was not proper, is a distinction that was clearly known to, debated between, and agreed to by all involved in negotiations. If an appellate point of error is based solely on subsection 4D2, then a case will be reversed if venue was improper in the ultimate county of suit, and will be affirmed if venue was proper therein. Okay. Other points of error directed at alleged errors at the motion to transfer hearing would be subject to the traditional appellate review standards. There will be no interlocutory trial at the interlocutory appeal, at the appeal on the merits of the cause. A point of error to the fact-finding made would simply be the trial court erred in failing to hold that an impartial trial could not be had in Morris County, Texas.
Affidavits again to determine that? We look at the pleadings and affidavits?
Look at the pleadings and affidavits, Your Honor, and there is no constitutional issue. Constitution, when it speaks to meaningful trials, refers to confrontation. All of the safeguards that's accorded in the rules of procedure are accorded in trial in deposition practice. We do it every day.
And
It has nothing to do with impartiality, impartial court, and impartial jury?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You say that the Constitution you mentioned here deals only with confrontation. And my question is, does it have anything to do with an impartial jury? Are the defendants entitled to an impartial jury?
That is a question to be decided by the trial court under the rules as to whether an impartial trial can be had.
Counsel.
I'm sorry.
Attorney Jim Perdue stood before us at an earlier time and said on his question, it's not an issue of plaintiff versus defendant, it's an issue of fairness. And when you talk about an impartial trial, you refer to confrontation. But you can have confrontation face-to-face, and you can have confrontation where one person shoots the other one in the back. It's still confrontation. Is this not an issue of fairness also?
Yes, it is, Your Honor, but that question has been decided for this court. The legislature has decided it. Now,
if you're correct, and I think what I hear you saying is you can harmonize the statute and the rules, and they're consistent if deposition testimony also is allowed.
Yes, sir.
And I could accept that as a harmonization. But it also says reasonable opportunity. We have to look and see whether or not a reasonable opportunity was afforded for deposition testimony to be offered when there were all these extensive hearings that presented to Judge Doggett's question about how long it was going to take and where it was going to be held. There'd be no need to have a high school auditorium just for the judge to read depositions in.
Your Honor,
they wouldn't be that voluminous.
Your Honor, if you'll just look at the boxes that's up here on this record, then I think you will conclude that reasonable opportunity for discovery was afforded.
But was there any need to rent a high school auditorium for a judge to read affidavits and depositions?
That was just to accommodate the number of counsel, wasn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. It was for lawyers, not witnesses. Are there any further questions?
Judge Campbell, a couple of questions. You mentioned earlier, I think at the very beginning, that you disputed the accuracy of the survey that the defendants had conducted. I take it that's in the record, and that means that and some other matters are factually in dispute. There are factual disputes on this issue, I take it.
We disputed that by deposition testimony, which is a part of which we filed. That is the only way we intended to dispute it.
And I take it that you don't anticipate that these issues would or could come up at trial or at any subsequent proceeding in this case. This is the last opportunity to present these issues, I take it.
Judge, I really hadn't thought about that, but I think that the same questions will come up on the voir dire.
Yes, but it would be kind of hard to present a survey to the jury that said we probably can't get a fair trial anymore.
Well, I would think that would be subject to being suspicious.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, John.
May it please the court, I'd like to devote most of my rebuttal time to responding more fully to some questions that have come from the bench. First of all, the question of why we should allow lengthy venue hearings under impartial trial venue determinations if we don't under conventional venue determinations. First of all is the fact that impartial trial determinations are not necessarily lengthy. This case, as I said, involved 4,200 claimants and 290 defendants.
You going to tell me that the defense counsel in a big case is not going to raise this and make an issue out of it in order to have a mini trial in advance as they did in the old previous venue?
Well, come on. Not in the run-of-the-mill case, Your Honor. That's what I'm telling you. In a big case, I'm sure it will happen. But what I'm telling you is that the mini trial is not going to be devoted, as the plea of privilege hearing was, to the merits of the case with the same evidence and the same witnesses and the same determinations being made as would later on be made at the trial. The other thing that distinguishes this from conventional venue is the importance of what we're trying to look for. If we make a mistake and we place venue of a case, conventional venue, in a county where there is an inadequate nexus, then A, that can be remedied by the proceedings at trial and then reversal on appeal. And B, we have merely caused some inconvenience. We have not affected the integrity of the fact-finding process. The impartial trial process under Rule 257 goes to the heart of the decision-making process, and if that determination is done erroneously or in an overly streamlined fashion, there is no remedy, because the trial that will then follow will be an unfair trial, and it will taint everything that is to follow in the case. So the difference in importance of the question before the court mandates the difference in procedure between the full mini-hearing on impartial trial venue and the abbreviated proceeding on conventional venue. Why can't we do this on the basis of discovery products and affidavits? I suppose in theory we can, but there is, to answer the Chief Justice's question, there is no analogy. There is no other process in Texas jurisprudence that works like this.
Well, would it have been an abuse of discretion if the trial judge had said, I simply don't have 8 weeks in my schedule to listen to you bring in witnesses from all across the nation. Take depositions of everybody you want and file them with me, and I'll read them at night.
If he had said that he would not hear any testimony, then yes, that would be an abuse of discretion. We're not saying he was required to hold an 8-week hearing as opposed to a 6-week or 4-week or whatever. One of the reasons for the 8-week hearing was the need to call all 290 corporate representatives. And what we had hoped for was after a few of those had been called that a stipulation would be elicited that the testimony of the others would be...
But the deposition testimony is trial testimony.
It is trial testimony.
It can be tried just on depositions, can it not? As opposed to just on affidavits.
It can be in theory, Your Honor, but we don't have any practice like that. At a special appearance hearing, at a trial on the merits, you have the right to read depositions. But you are not relegated to that form of proof, and there is no trial lawyer that won't tell you that presenting live testimony is 10 times as effective as reading a deposition.
But didn't the legislature do this deliberately to avoid the full-blown trial?
To avoid the full...
And that was the compromise reached?
To avoid the full-blown trial on the merits. And if you look at 15064, that's what it says. No factual proof regarding the merits of the case shall be required to establish venue. Now, with respect
to... Counsel, you said you were going to call 290 corporate representatives to testify?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Were all of them residents of Morris County?
No, Your Honor.
Were any of them residents of Morris County?
Some of them were, Your Honor.
And they were going to testify that they couldn't get a fair trial in...
In their opinion, the rule requires affidavits from the party, which in the case of a corporation would be its representative. So we felt the need to call those people to satisfy our obligation to produce evidence from the party. As I said, we hope for a stipulation after a few of them that the remaining testimony would be cumulative.
You could have done that by either affidavit or deposition, couldn't you?
We could have, but whether that would have been the same as live testimony is the question.
Did you ask to take video depositions?
We did not, Your Honor, because we anticipated a live hearing based on what the trial court had done and the arrangements that had been made. Really, the corporate representatives were not the key elements at this hearing. The key elements would have been the survey and the testimony of the individual plaintiffs. And it simply is not an appropriate practice to have complex evidence such as a survey like this, which, as Justice Campbell points out, was hotly controverted, to be resolved by the trial court reading one deposition and hearing how good the survey is, reading another deposition and hearing how bad the survey was, and not having an opportunity to ask questions of his own, not having the opportunity for counsel for each party to interactively cross-examine the other party's witnesses, and that has simply not been in our jurisprudence an acceptable substitute for the oral hearing at which the parties confront the judge, at which they have the perception, and the public has the perception that the judge has considered their evidence. And we don't believe that comports with Rule 258 requiring trial by the judge.
What do you do with the language of the statute that says the court shall determine venue questions from the pleading and affidavits?
Your Honor, we submit that read in context, the impartial trial determination under Rule 258 is not a venue question within the meaning of that provision. Venue questions relate to the nexus between the cause of action or the parties and the place of trial. The venue question is already long behind us by the time we have our Rule 258 hearing. And that's pointed out by Senator Caperton's article where he relates the second sentence of 15064A to the first sentence where he says, no proof on the merits, instead the court shall determine venue questions from the pleadings and affidavits. And that's the context we think that that sentence has to be read in. We don't think you can take it as an isolated sentence and say, well, that says venue questions and 258 is a venue question.
Any other questions? Thank you.
That concludes the arguments in the first call. The court will take a brief recess.
Audience will please rise.